You may or may not be pleased to know that there's more than a hint of the bacchanalian about this week's Living World. Not that any of those here gathered are going to be indulging in any drunken revelries. More a happy celebration of a plant closely associated with the ancient god of wine and bringer of ecstasy. A common hedgerow plant, often overlooked, evergreen, found almost everywhere over Britain, a plant we call the ivy. And here with me, standing on a bridge of the Central Wales line here in Mid Wales, Ray Woods, botanist with Plant Life. Ray, I mean, ivy is such a common and overlooked plant, but who and what is the ivy? Who are its relatives?
Right, well, this is our only true woody evergreen climber in this country. And it's the one representative of a mostly tropical family called the Araliaceae. If you enjoy taking a swig of ginseng, you'll have got that from the Araliaceae. And if you ever want to make your coconut pyramids sticking on the old rice paper, it's not made out of rice, but it's made out of the pith from one of the Araliaceae, beaten out into fine sheets. So it has some other uses, but it's a mostly tropical genus, and we're here right on the western and northern edge of the range of the family.
The ivy is a remarkable plant, as we'll learn in the next 20 minutes or so, but remarkable for the fact that it actually produces its flowers, its pollen, its nectar at this time of the year, end of autumn, start of winter.
Yes, I think this is very much a feature of the fact that its centre of distribution is somewhere a lot further south, where probably it was a lot drier. It had to wait for the autumn to come along, for the rains to provide it with the extra moisture in which to be able to grow rapidly, flower and produce fruits. When I first moved into Mid Wales 30 years ago, it was a rare sight to see the fruits on ivy, because usually the frost was so severe it shriveled all the flowers off. It never managed to fruit successfully. But now, with a warmer climate, it fruits regularly, and it's definitely becoming a much, much more common, even pest-like species, dare I say, in some places.
So where do you fall on the pest, not-so-pestilent species as far as ivy is concerned? Some people don't like it because they say it strangles trees. Other people like it because it provides such wonderful food for insects at this time of the year.
I think both opinions are probably correct in one place or another. Yes, in my own garden, for example, where it grows up, young trees are, for example, older. It can compress and so strangle the wood as to inhibit the growth of the tree. But on a tree like hawthorn, with a much harder wood, the hawthorn seems to resist it, and it never manages to do much in the way of strangling. And oaks tend to get away. Anything with a rather dense canopy keeps the ivy in check, but with a lighter canopy the ivy can grow more vigorously and get away, and occasionally it will strangle trees.
Many plants, Ray, their Latin names have a great meaning if you translate them into English, but what about the ivy? Hedera Helix.
Hedera helix, yes. A lot of debate about this. I like the story that it might be derived from a Celtic word. The word was hedra, which means a cord. Otherwise, it's a very ancient word used by Pliny. Greeks and Romans use hedera for this climbing plant, and otherwise we seem not to really understand its origins. The helix bit, well, that's possibly because of the spiralling around. It encompasses trees, grows round them, turns about them, and that's the helix, the side of hedera helix. And of course, for the other species we've got in this country, which is hedera hibernica, this of course refers to the fact that it's the only ivy that occurs in Ireland.
Let's have a look at this. I mean, here we have ivy. What are they called? Stems, fronds, branches?
Yeah, I think it's stems growing up from a little bit of soil at the base of a wall.
The immediate difference is that that's clinging to the wall with its little adventitious roots, the shape of the leaves are so different than the flower branches which are pointing up in the air coming out of that plant.
That's right. It's one of these few plants that has these very, very distinctive change in leaf shape with age. So we have this juvenile form with these five-pointed leaves. And at some stage in its life, a switch is pressed. We don't know how or what causes it, but it suddenly changes to this arborescent, this tree phase in which the leaves become oval. And once that switch has been pressed, you can't go back. So if you take cuttings from this, from the arborescent form, and put them down at ground level, it still remains as a shrub or tree-like plant. It doesn't grow into these long trailing shoots.
A fairly typical mid-Wales day today. We haven't got a lot of sunshine. But what light and what sunshine there is on the centre of the bridge. Let's move over there, because there's a great growth of ivy on the top of the parapet there, which seems to be in much more flower than this here. In front of us, the parapet of the bridge that crosses the railway line here, the ivy atop it. It's still in full flower. He described the flower itself. We've got to get very close indeed. The fact that this is on the parapet and eye height is going to aid us, but I take us through it. I mean, because it is the most extraordinary looking flower.
On one branch here, we've probably got 50 separate tiny little greenish yellow flowers. They're all clustered together like a starburst firework going poof in the sky. You know, each little flower's got a stalk and they all come out from the same point. And there's probably half a dozen of these individual starbursts all clustered together. So it's a sort of compound umbel. The ovary is situated behind all the gubbins of the stamens and the stigma as a sort of spherical structure. And the nectar is sitting on top of this spherical structure with five stamens sticking out and five stigmas in there. Well, we can't see many petals, can we, on these flowers?
Can't see any petals, in fact.
Well, if we look hard in the middle here, there's one there with a few. Because they fall off almost immediately. They've given up on the whole business of advertising their presence with petals, like most flowers have. Instead, they produce lots and lots of nectar, and the scent of that presumably attracts in all the insects. So the clustering of the flowers together advertises them so much more successfully. It's also a flower that has to be cross-pollinated. Some flowers, if insects don't turn up, can pollinate themselves. But with the ivy, the pollen's got to end up on a completely different plant. Lots of nectar makes it very attractive, and that's how it seems to function then. And eventually, once these flowers have been pollinated, they'll develop into a berry, and like the stamens, which are five in number, the little chambers inside the ovary there are five in number as well. But they can produce anything up to 10 seeds. But the seeds are amazing little structures. I get brought these funny little pink pearls in the spring often from people who say, "What on earth is this? I've just found it on my lawn." And I have to explain that it's come out of the back of a bird and it was the results of a bird eating one of these big ivy berries, digesting all the flesh off and leaving these wonderful little pink pearl-like seeds. Which, again, nobody ever brought these seeds to me 10 or 15 years ago. I think another indication of how very much more common ivy berries are and the fruits of ivy seem to be now.
In that case, why don't we get lots of little ivy trees, bushes, shrubs or whatever they're called, growing in the middle of our lawn? Because I find these pink pearls in the middle of my lawn. Does it have to be in association with a structure like this bridge parapet?
No, I think not. I mean, they're a bit slow to germinate. It's the following spring before they germinate. They don't germinate in the same year in which the ivy flowers. But no, I mean, I get them coming up in plant pots in the greenhouse because I use leaf mould. I make my own compost using some leaf mould and they come up all over the place. You probably don't notice them when you mow them off because they are quite slow into growth. They produce these rather leathery leaves. They've got leaves, you see, they're quite long lasting. They last more than a single year, as many evergreens do. It's an interesting business, isn't it? Why evergreen? And I think this plant, rather like holly, it lives on the sort of edges of woodland, and most of the time in the summer months it's too shady for it to do much good. But in the autumn, when the leaves are shed from the trees, the sunlight's lower, the light streams in under the trees, the ivy's growing up. This is the time when it makes most of its growth. This is the time when it flowers. And it keeps these evergreen leaves. It's a bit of a problem if it's very frosty, and that's why ivy doesn't occur very far north. It doesn't get far into Norway. It doesn't get far into the heart of Central Europe. It's very much a plant of the periphery, rather like holly. And in fact, the Americans love ivy because it's not native over there. They've grown our ivy, all the varieties. But in Central America, it's a plant of greenhouses. It doesn't grow in the harsh centres, you know, with frosty, snowy conditions.
You've said that we now recognise two species of ivy here in Britain. We are in Western Britain. Mm. So which species is this?
Right, this one, if we look closely with a magnifying glass and look at the leaves and the young stems, you'll see these little star-shaped hairs. And the hairs on this particular one look like they've been ironed flat, pressed close to the leaf surface. And it's also got a rather pleasant, wonderfully resinous aroma. And this is the Atlantic ivy.
Right. I'm scraping a bit of the bark with my... Oh, yes. Yeah. So, but we can rely on the scratch and sniff method to separate them.
I think
this
so.
This one smells quite pleasant.
Right.
Quite pungent.
Resinous.
Resinous
of
the smell. Right. Yes. Not an unpleasant smell. Now, I often associate the smell of ivy with, what's it called? Stinking Irish.
Yes, or decaying parsley or something.
Is that a
like
different
that.
Species?
Something that makes me shudder, rather.
Yeah.
That's the common ivy, which occurs over England and over most of the continent. So we've only recently decided that this Atlantic ivy is sufficiently different to be accorded full species status. There is a garden form of it with these enormous big glossy leaves. Any of you live in, you know, places like Bristol or London or Manchester, you'll see all the old Victorian gardens jam-packed full of this enormous leaved ivy. That's a big leaf form of this Atlantic ivy. We call that the Irish ivy. Interestingly, The Atlantic ivy has twice as many chromosomes as the common ivy as well.
Which How does that work then?
Well, various plants develop, the chromosomes get doubled up, a mistake's made at some stage. But it does mean that the common ivy can't cross with the Atlantic ivy because it makes a complete mess up of its chromosome numbers. And they've obviously evolved, but what interests me is the Atlantic ivy on a world scale is incredibly rare. It's just down this wonderful Atlantic seaboard and down into the Canary Islands and just fringing the Atlantic. And again, it's probably a species that is even more frost sensitive than the common ivy, and that's what helps to differentiate the distribution of the two.
There are a huge amount of garden cultivars of ivy. Are they cultivars of the common ivy or the Irish ivy?
Both, interestingly. There are far more of the common ivy, because that's a much more extensive species than the Atlantic ivy. I've got catalogues. Some suppliers will offer over 100 different forms, and the leaves are just extraordinary. In my own garden, I grow a wide range of them just out of curiosity. Some of them with leaves that are divided up and look like birds' feet. And there are others which have got leaves that look like little daggers, and others with almost rounded leaves. Some of them with the leaves just lacerated and shredded. I mean, an extraordinary range, and I have no explanation, but buttercup ivy is one I love. That was found as recently as 1920 in Ireland. The tips of the shoots go bright yellow. You'll see this about, it's quite common in gardens. Well-lit sites, all the shoot tips keep bright yellow, but eventually as the leaves age, they turn green. And that's a very famous one called the buttercup ivy. So whenever you go on a country walk, keep your eyes open, because this diversity is all about you, and you just might find some incredibly new form of ivy. And I think it adds immense interest to my walk, searching for these odd and weird forms of ivy.
But these cultivars are rising as sports quite naturally in the wild environment, rather than being taken into cultivation and cultivated
as such. Originally these sports would have come from the wild, but of course as we grow more and more ivy, the sports themselves have sported their own branches. And this rather interestingly has created some problems. I tried to write a book many years ago in which I was trying to list the origins of all these weird and wonderful forms of wild plants we grow in our gardens. When I got to ivy, I just got hopelessly lost. There are hundreds of them.
So we're here in largely Western Britain. So what species are we looking at here? Where's the boundaries between the Irish ivy and the English ivy, as it were?
Well, we're still investigating this, because it'll be the next edition of the standard British Flora which will have the two recognised species. So until recently, a lot of botanists have not bothered to differentiate, because they were only considered to be subspecies at best. But certainly, I mean, if you go to somewhere like Cardiganshire, where the ivy has been very well studied, all the ivy in Cardiganshire is the Atlantic ivy. Whereas if you go into somewhere like the old county of Monmouthshire, Gwent, and I think there are only probably two or three records of the Atlantic ivy, and all the ivy over there appears to be the common ivy. And shame, we're right on the divide here, just south of Llandrinod Wells. I can't tell you at present what happens in Scotland, but I would guess in the West Scotland it'll be the Atlantic ivy, in East Scotland it'll be the common ivy, and certainly Devon and Cornwall I expect it to be Atlantic ivy.
I've done the scratch and sniff on this, so this is the nice resinous smell, so it's the Atlantic ivy, is that right?
That's right. And I've looked at this with a hand lens, and all the little hairs are ironed flat onto the leaves and onto the stem. So that's definitely, from the hair test, this is the Atlantic ivy. So let's have a look at the other one.
Move across to the other one. It looks ostensibly the same at a distance, I have to say. It's a great growth of flowering stems sticking up on the top. And it's quite beautiful at a distance, isn't it?
I think it's a gorgeous plant. You can see why it's got the gardeners have so loved it. I go back into Victorian times, and everybody talked lovingly about these ivy-clad ruins. But now, of course, oh gosh, we don't seem to like ivy on these buildings. But it was always thought to be so romantic to have these ivy-covered ruins. But now we take it all down. We don't like it.
When I was a boy, there was a chap clearing ivy off one of his outhouses, and I was full of wrens and robin's nests and things like that, and I asked him why he was doing it. He said, "Ah, boy, it does suck all the goodness out the mortar." But there's another myth attached to the adventitious roots, these little roots that the ivy uses to cling to the wall, and that is actually doing damage. Does it?
The adventitious roots, if they stayed short and stubby and just used themselves for clinging, wouldn't cause a problem. But unfortunately, at various intervals, wherever they detect a nice little moist patch, they put out proper roots, and those roots can swell and crack. Ivy on a well-built, fairly modern structure can be an advantage, but once it gets onto some of these decaying structures, there's no doubt that it can assist and speed up the process of decomposition. Well, right. Arnold, what do you think about the smell of this?
Hang on, yeah, you've had a look at it with your thing. A thing is a hand lens, if you don't understand. Oh, that's quite different.
You think so? Well, I'm not so certain.
You're not so certain.
Come on, have another scratch and have another smell.
Well, no. Hang on. Yes, it's a rather cold day here, so my sniffer isn't working that. No, it has got a resinous smell now.
The hairs are flat on this, so this is. But when we look closely at the flowers here, we see that, oh gosh, yes, look, the first truss, you might say, of flowers has actually finished flowering, but the rest are still buds. So, in fact, this particular clump of ivy is already in the midst of flowering. It's just that the first flowers are finished and the next ones haven't opened, whereas the clump further on is still actively flowering.
One of the other extraordinary things about ivy is the gap between flowering, which is when it's fertilised and to produce berries, is so small, isn't it? A lot of things that are going to be buried at this time of the year relied on the fact that they were going to be pollinated early in the spring. So the gap between pollination and berry maturation is quite long. Here we've got a flower that's going to produce berries quite soon.
That's right. Ivy has to develop its fruits now before we get the really hard conditions of the winter. And if it's a really hard winter, they actually never develop. But of course, it's a very long-lived plant. How long? Well, that's quite questionable. I mean, the ancients, the poets used to refer to these thousand-year-old ivy-covered ruins. Was the ivy 1,000 years old? There's certainly evidence of ivy plants in excess of 400 years old. It's curious that in some of the old poems, I can't remember the one at present, but it was thought that owls used to feed on ivy berries, wasn't it?
Yes.
Considering what good observations many of the ancients made of our wildlife, that was surely rather at fault that I don't believe owls ever eat ivy berries. There's this other old saying, a good wine needs no bush. In medieval times, one of the best pub signs was an ivy bush. They used to shove a great big bough of ivy to indicate that this is a tavern. But of course, if you were serving really good wine, you didn't need to advertise yourself because everybody knew. And in fact, there was an Act of Parliament passed in 1375 which restricted the size of the ivy insigns to only 7 feet. About 2 metres. You weren't allowed a bigger bush. So presumably the odd one must have fallen and killed somebody. Maybe this is an early example of health and safety.
But I've always thought the bacchanalian connection was the fact that ivy was used in some form to brew a very strong alcoholic drink in the past. Lend a lie to the story that ivy is supposed to be poisonous?
Yeah, this is a problematic area. Yes, the berries themselves do contain one or two rather unfortunate chemicals, saponin, soap-like products, which can break down your red blood cells, cause kidney problems, and also people have suffered from hallucinations and they've collapsed and things, having eaten a surfeit of too many ivy berries. But by and large, the leaves are not that poison. In fact, by and large, ivy has been considered by a lot of farmers as a useful tonic for livestock. A sheep that's looking a bit peaky, if you give it a few ivy leaves, you said if it eats them, it's going to survive. If it doesn't, it'll die anyway. I mean, I'm interested in this problem because of the conservation impact of ivy on other species, particularly the lichens and mosses that live on trees. Somewhere like Scotland, you will find that all the bases of the trees are bare because the red deer browse all the ivy off in the winter, snowier winters.
But they graze the lichens off as well.
Well,
so I'm not giving you an excuse to be around the woods of Wales with your hatchet cutting down the ivy. So when my school teacher used to say, when I used to gather ivy berries as a schoolboy to use in my pea shooter, you mustn't do that, Kellaway, because you'll poison yourself. That was just kidology, wasn't it?
No, there are too many. If you suck too many the wrong way, so they'll blow them. You might feel a little bit unwell, Arnold.
But are there any commercial uses for ivy?
The leather workers, for example, used to use a bit of ivy wood as a whetstone to sharpen a fine edge onto the knives before they cut through leather. It was used also for handles because if you turn it and it comes to look rather pale with a little dark grain in it, it looks a bit like ivory, so you can kid people you've got ivory handles to your knives. And then there's another bit that fascinates me. In medieval times, there was a substance called lacquer. which was apparently a wonderful pink or reddish dye stuff. But nobody seems to understand how it was ever acquired from ivy. And it gives its name to lac, which is shellac, bright red vermilion dye stuff, which is produced from a range of trees which have been attacked by various piercing and sucking insects. And as a result of their activities, these trees bleed this resin to defend themselves. And this is then scraped off and produces the shellac that we're so familiar with. But you hardly ever see this. In fact, I never saw this on ivy, and it puzzled me immensely until earlier this year in the west of Ireland. What did I find? I found these big globules of this wonderful, pearly, aromatic resin oozing out of just one ivy stem. Don't know what caused that. Maybe it wasn't a strange insect attack. Maybe, you know, once upon a time in medieval times, we did have an insect in Europe which induced ivy to produce these resinous materials, and maybe it's no longer with us. I don't know. This is still one of life's mysteries. So any of the listeners out there, if you can shed any light on this, if you've got ivies, for example, that bleeds this wonderful aromatic resin, I'd love to know where it is and how it does it.
Ray, you keep bees, so
yes.
do you ever get ivy honey?
It's so late, I don't think you would normally extract. I mean, I should have already stolen the honey from my bees. And of course, the advantage, if they can get out and feed on the ivy, is that I don't have to feed them so much sugar to get them through the winter. Yeah, anything they can get their little proboscis in and suck up. Yeah, ivy would be great if they could make use of it. In some parts of the country, beekeepers, you know, would say it's the difference between profit and loss having lots of ivy flowers in order to stoke the bees up for the winter, because they don't have to feed them sugar.
Well, I think we've probably done ivy good justice today. It's been a fascinating programme, and what would make the icing on the cake or the beer in the glass would be to find a local pub with an ivy bush outside it, wouldn't it?
There's one not that far down the road from here, I do recall, Lionel.
Well, perhaps there's a chance for our bacchanalian revelry even yet, then.
Yeah.
The Living World was presented by Lionel Kellaway and produced by Andrew Dawes.